we're going to be focusing on the latest news from Supercomputing 23, including a big existential question of what does supercomputing and HPC hardware really mean? In other stories we're covering this week, the U.S. is freeing up more spectrum for 5G. AMD Milan-based cloud instances are doing really well over at Google. YouTube is requiring people to label AI-generated realistic content. Dell and Hugging Face have struck a deal for open-source Gen AI in the enterprise. Microsoft, oops, blocked ChatGPT access for employees. And we were attending Commvault Shift last week. What does that mean for data protection? Stay tuned for the Gestalt IT Rundown. Welcome to the Gestalt IT Rundown, where each time we meet, we run down the IT news of the week with a variable degree of snarkiness. Stephen Foskett, and joining me today as my co-host, filling in for Tom Hollingsworth, who's out at Mobility Field Day, is Mr. Tim Bertino. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Stephen, it is a pleasure to be back. You know, I gotta say, the only benefit to not attending the Field Day events that Tom hosts is that I get to come on here and chat with you about the news and throw some snark in there, like you mentioned.
Absolutely. I know that we can rely on you, Tim, every time. It's great to have you. Also, I would like to point out that today is not only is today National Recycling Day and National Steve Irwin Day, it is also National I Love to Write Day. And I do love to write. Do you like to write?
I am a blogger at heart. So yes, writing is near the top of the list for me.
Excellent. So let's dive into some of the news of the week before we go and read your fascinating, scintillating prose. On Monday, the Biden administration in the U.S. announced steps it plans to take to free up some more wireless spectrum currently set aside for federal government use. It's hoping that this can be allocated to wireless service providers to provide more bandwidth for 5G. What does this increasing demand for wireless service mean? And what about satellites? What about government use? What about private use? Is everything 5G now?
Stephen, I do think it throws some writing on the wall for potential changes and what it means for the future of how we as a people access the internet. While I don't think that, you know, the fiber in the ground is going away, there's still a lot of that that's getting installed new. However, I think we're seeing more people that are accessing the internet primarily through wireless means. And 5G is really prevalent for that. 5G also has use cases for secondary connectivity for companies that maybe want to throw in a backup circuit for an SD-WAN provider. They may use 5G, but I do think that it is starting to get used more primarily. And also, where I think this could change the game is, as we talk about in the U.S., wanting to get more people connected to the internet, we're talking rural broadband, I think could be a big play for use cases like 5G and those low orbit satellites, where we may not have to trench all of this fiber and connectivity in the ground out to these rural areas. And these folks could still get connected to the internet via means like 5G and low orbit satellites. So I do think that this is an interesting story, but I also think that it was probably inevitable as we need to find new and you know, really different ways of getting people connected to the internet. So, Stephen, Google introduced new TAW VMs with AMD Milan processors demonstrating a performance edge over rivals AWS and Azure. Previously, x86 cloud instances were compared with ARM on a vCPU versus physical CPU basis, but the new AMD platform allows Google to focus on physical x86 cores. This upsets the playing field as Google offers far better performance than both ARM and vCPU-based x86 cloud. What sort of impact will this have in terms of public cloud computing?
Yeah, this is a huge one. And I want to call out the presentation that we saw from Robert Hormuth from AMD at our recent Cloud Field Day event. In that presentation, one of the sort of underlying messages that he was talking about was basically the impact that that the new AMD processors, the Zen 4C and the Zen 4 generally, can have on cloud computing space. And I think a lot of the cloud delegates around the table were kind of putting two and two together and saying, wait a second, if we've got so many CPUs, physical CPUs, then maybe x86 can compete with AMD-based Graviton and Ampere systems on a physical CPU to physical CPU basis, instead of basically over-provisioning with virtual CPUs. And that's exactly what we're seeing here. So essentially, Google's Tau VMs using AMD's Milan processors allow Google to offer much, much better performance, not just better than ARM, which is not a surprise on a core-to-core basis when you're not virtualizing, but also better than x86 on Amazon, which may be surprising. But of course, if you're comparing physical CPUs to virtual CPUs, in other words, you know, physical CPUs to hyper-threaded virtual CPUs, it's no surprise that Google is outperforming them. Personally, I think this is a sign of things to come. We already know that AMD is going to be doubling down, tripling down on their use of the Zen 4C processors in the cloud, and that these processors are complete full-featured processors. Yes, they're stripped down somewhat from the Zen 4, but you can pack a ton of them into a processor, which means that we could have much more powerful CPUs available in the cloud from AMD very, very soon. And this Google announcement shows that that's working. But don't, you know, put all your bets on AMD yet, because of course Intel has also announced that they're going to offer many, many, many core CPU platform for the cloud as well. Now theirs is based on their efficiency cores, so it's not exactly the same thing. It's not exactly apples to apples. But the idea of ARM basically wiping the floor with x86, thanks to having tons of efficient cores, well, that may be changing in the cloud. Earlier this week, YouTube announced a new policy that requires content creators to disclose when any part of their content was generating using AI tools. The goal here seems to be to try to keep consumers informed about how the content they're viewing was created. The interesting point is that these labels are only required for AI-generated content that is deemed realistic. Examples of realistic AI-generated content that were given include a depiction of an event that didn't actually happen, or someone declaring something they never actually said. Is this the right play to help curb misinformation and disinformation in an AI-heavy world? And what about the rest of AI-generated content?
Well, Stephen, this is unfortunately another use case that we have to be cognizant of about using tools like AI for good or evil. Unfortunately, we thought it was difficult in the past to know what was real and what was fake. And now it's going to become even more difficult. And I will argue already has. I do think this is interesting in that what YouTube's really trying to do here is make people understand, or try to help people understand, what it is that they're viewing and how it was created. So they're trying to put a tag or a flag on videos to have people disclose, hey, was any of this generated by some sort of an AI tool and not all from a human? And to make it even more interesting, it sounds like, and I don't know if this is the end game, but it sounds like they're really just starting with things that are deemed, quote, realistic, which I think can open a big can of worms. And I like what they're trying to do here to show in people that, hey, what you're viewing may not have been or was not created 100% by a human, and there were AI tools involved. Where I think is going to be difficult is, how are they going to police that? You're going to have, in my mind, you're going to have either AI tools combating AI tools, or you're going to have to dedicate humans to ensure that people are reviewing this content and checking to see, okay, does it appear that AI tools were used in the creation of this content? And then if so, is that okay? Is this satire? Is this something real that we think is, that again, quote, realistic, that we need to address and make sure that it's flagged appropriately? And you asked, Stephen, is it really just this realistic content that we're worried about? Personally, I think that's probably what we're worried about day one. But I do think with the amount of AI tools that are going to be saturating the environment in the future, eventually that is probably going to have to be stated for any content created. I think, at least for the time being, I would personally like to know if something that I'm viewing was created by somebody that I know knows what they're talking about, or if it was a data lake essentially out there that an AI tool is pulling this information from, and me having to second guess or check that as well. Not that we can't always trust humans, but we definitely want to make sure that we know where our information's coming from. So Stephen, Dell and Hugging Face, bonus points for the name of that company, by the way, have teamed up to deploy customized Gen AI models on Dell servers and storage products. The Hugging Face Dell portal will offer users dedicated containers and scripts for easy deployment. Does this reflect a significant step in advancing artificial intelligence capabilities in the enterprise, or is it just another partnership?
Yeah, well, it is another partnership, sure. And honestly, it reflects sort of what you would hope that companies like Dell would do. But I think that it really shows an underlying unease with what's going on in the AI space, as we're going to talk about in our Closer Look story when we turn to supercomputing this year. So essentially, the goal of this announcement is, of course, for Dell to sell more equipment. You know, Dell makes really great storage appliances. They have validated designs for AI based on their PowerEdge and NVIDIA's H100 GPUs. Dell is absolutely leaning in heavily to the AI market. Now, the challenge there is that enterprises are still, I think, trying to figure out how to do AI. Well, Dell's there to help. By partnering with Hugging Face, they are essentially making it really easy for companies to develop AI models around Hugging Face's language models, and then to deploy them, not in the cloud, but on premises. This is huge because there's another story that's happening this week, and that is that OpenAI, once again, is so popular. ChatGPT has become so popular that OpenAI is restricting signups. And in fact, they're restricting the ability of people to log in this very morning. I'm hearing reports from folks on Mastodon and X Twitter saying, I can't log in. ChatGPT won't let me in. Why? Because it's just too darn popular. Well, if you're in an enterprise and you're trying to use ChatGPT technology, well, the good news is it looks like the API is still working fine. But if you're trying to use this stuff, being told you as a paying customer can't log in is not what you want to hear. So what are you going to do? Well, just like other cloud applications, I think enterprises are starting to realize that the cost and the responsibility chain of relying on a cloud service is maybe not what they want to do. What they'd love to do is deploy these models in-house and basically escape from all that as a service nonsense. Well, that's what this is all about. I think that this is very, very smart for Dell to do this. It's not enough to develop good hardware. You also have to develop and sell that hardware in a way that customers want to use it. And that is what Dell is doing. So is this an important announcement? Well, on the face of it, probably not. But does this show that Dell is doing the right thing in AI and in bringing AI to the enterprise? 100%. For a brief period of time last Thursday, Microsoft restricted employee access to OpenAI's ChatGPT platform. The reasoning was posted on an internal website and stated, due to security and data concerns, a number of AI tools are no longer available for employees to use. Further comments from Microsoft explained that because ChatGPT is a third-party service, employees need to use caution to exercise concerns of risks and privacy and security. A later statement from Microsoft said that the temporary block was a mistake, resulting from a test of other systems and other controls for large language models. And this is no surprise, considering that OpenAI and Microsoft are very, very close partners, and Microsoft is a huge user of ChatGPT. Do companies need policies to restrict employees? And what does this say about Microsoft?
Yay, more AI turmoil. This is great. And this is a great lead-in from the last story that we just talked about, is The first thing I think to say here that's very interesting is what you just mentioned, Stephen, in that Microsoft is heavily invested in OpenAI, but they did state in here to their employees that yes, while we are heavily invested, that is a third-party tool. And why I wanted to bring this up is something that I think needs to be continued to be talked about when it comes to AI is a large component of artificial intelligence is data. And it's important, especially when you're running a business, that you understand who controls that data. Hopefully it's you, and who has accessibility to that data. And where this can get dangerous in leveraging platforms like ChatGPT is intellectual property. You want to make sure that what you're putting into these systems that are potentially open is not proprietary data that you're worried about. Where I also found this story interesting is that it seemed like it was very fluid throughout the day for the reasoning. It started as a statement saying, hey, we need to be careful. This is an outside tool. We need to watch what we're doing when we're using this. And then it seemed to evolve throughout the day to then become, actually, this block was a mistake. It should not have happened. We didn't mean to do it. So I'd really be interested to know what all transpired on that day. But it really comes back to me being a data privacy and security conversation. You mentioned in the previous story, Stephen, that a use case for bringing these types of workloads on-prem for availability use cases and standpoints, I would also add in for security and data privacy, that these need to be controlled by, these environments need to be controlled by the company that's leveraging them. And there probably needs to be policies in place around leveraging these platforms like ChatGPT, Google Bard, et cetera, and the ones that'll come in the future. So, Stephen, this seems really interesting. Gestalt IT was part of Commvault Shift last week as the leading data protection company pivoted and relaunched Commvault Cloud, a software as a service platform powered by Metallic AI. The event signals a strategic move to address evolving cyber threats, and this was underscored by the speakers and content as seen in the coverage of the Gestalt IT community. Stephen, what did you take away from this event and Commvault shift into something new?
Well, yeah, it was great to be part of this. I think that this was a great event. It was a very enjoyable event for me. Handled, well planned, well executed. It was also great that Commvault was willing to bring Gestalt IT on site to basically do our thing, our independent technical analysis and business analysis, and that we did. So we were there in New York. We covered the discussions. We also had a lot of behind the scenes discussions with the folks from Commvault and their customers and board members. And overall, I would say that this is a really solid move for Commvault. So here's what's happening. Essentially, all the companies in the data protection space have realized that the primary use case for data protection is no longer recovering oopsies from internal use. It's actually protecting against cyber threats. And that has been a real game changer in this enterprise data protection space, to the point that data protection really is more of a security concern now than it ever was a storage concern. And that's also meaning that data protection is more important to companies. This was underscored, actually, by one of Commvault's advisors. So during this announcement, the last presentation was Sanjay Merchandani, the CEO of Commvault, talking to Melissa Hathaway, who is an extremely respected cybersecurity expert who's joined a cyber advisory board for Commvault. And one of the things that Hathaway said really, really hit home, which is that it's time for companies to basically plan for their worst day ever. And their worst day is no longer what it used to be. Their worst day is now cyber threats. And that means that cybersecurity and cyber resilience have to be a not just a an IT problem, not just a business problem, but a board level concern. That came home in the after hours conversations as well with Commvault customers, with some new folks. Commvault has a new field CTO, Alex Janis, who comes from this space as well. And the rest of the Commvault management, they all were leaning into this message that cyber resilience isn't an IT problem. It is a business problem. Now, the problem with making this a business problem is that a lot of IT product companies are not ready to have that conversation. Now, you know, they might be able to get themselves an audience, you know, with the C-level, the CIO, the CEO, even maybe the board. The problem is when they get in there, a lot of them are going to shoot themselves in the foot by talking bits and bytes and product and tech instead of talking the real world threats and what companies can really do about it. That's why it's important for me not just to look at the product that Commvault is delivering, which is impressive, but the people who are delivering that message. And I think that really came home from Commvault Shift. As I mentioned, they had speakers who were very much experts in cybersecurity, not experts in data protection. And I feel like Commvault management has really focused on this. Of course, the product does cool things too. So they've unified the product now. It's Commvault Cloud. It's a SaaS product. It's really focused on cyber readiness. It has some pretty cool things like AI-based threat detection, which is actually a very good use for machine learning technology, as well as rapid recovery, including clean room recovery in Microsoft Azure, which, again, very, very smart, because this is one of the problems, right? Okay, I've got my data, but where do I put it and make sure that it's not still infected with ransomware or that it's not going to be accessible to criminals? Well, you spin up an environment in Azure automatically using this, and it just works. So the product looks good. It's going in the right direction. But more importantly, it is more important, the company is going in the right direction. And that's what I like to see. Now let's turn and take a closer look at another big event that's happening right now. Supercomputing 23 is being held in Denver this week. And we're on the lookout for the best, latest, most important news. Now, of course, every supercomputing event, we look for the new list of top 500 supercomputers, and we try to read the tea leaves about what that means, not just for this HPC space, but also for the enterprise. And we're going to do that. We're also, of course, hearing more and more from NVIDIA. I mean, they're the big gorilla in this space, and NVIDIA just came in with another body blow with the GH200 Grace Hopper superchip. But of course, they've got a lot more than that. They're powering supercomputers like Jupiter. They've got really great, kind of next generation HGX and so on. We're also seeing a lot of other announcements here. But one of the biggest topics of discussion, at least among the people that I follow that are attending supercomputing, is not about the technology. It's about HPC itself. What does it really mean to live in an exascale world? And does living in an exascale world really matter? And does it make sense anymore to talk about exascale and scale beyond that when everything is so AI and accelerator focused? I mean, is an AI accelerator supercomputer still the same flavor of exascale? And I think that that's one of the interesting questions here. Tim, what's your reaction overall to the news from supercomputing?
Well, like you said, there's definitely a shift in how we're doing things within what would be a traditional data center environment. And scaling, which I think we'll get into later on, is a big part of that, right? And to start this off, Stephen, I think I bring it up just about every time I'm on here with you. I am not the compute nor storage enthusiast that you are, but I did have the opportunity earlier this year with the Art of Network Engineering team. We got to go visit the Oak Ridge National Laboratory where supercomputers such as Frontier live. And it really opened my eyes to both the scale and the use cases for these systems, what they can be used for, how they can be accessed. And I do think that AI is really going to drive that discussion. In fact, recently I got to attend Networking Field Day with Tom, and Intel presented there and showed us, because you know me, I like to put that networking spin on everything. They showed us how data centers are really built, HPC environments are really built from a networking standpoint, and where there are different use cases such as Ethernet versus InfiniBand, and how you really want to, much like in the traditional networking sense, how we try to separate normal data plane traffic from management traffic. That really seems to be the path forward for HPC and AI data center networking, is to separate that those AI networks from everything else. So you can really limit that latency and basically let those workloads do what they're meant to do. So I do think we are going to see more and more play in this space for HPC, more supercomputers, which is going to drive, near and dear to my heart, higher networking capacity and really the need for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that interconnect is one of the areas that people are really focused on when they're thinking about taking HPC technology out of the national labs and into the data center in the cloud. Certainly, that's one of the areas that companies like NVIDIA, AMD, Broadcom, Intel, and so on are focused on. But it's one of the things I think that is also a, I don't say red flag, but a bit of a yellow flag in terms of scaling, because we as an industry really have to figure out how are we going to adapt to this world? How are we actually going to build ourselves, zettascale supercomputers when we're still struggling to deploy exascale? So I do want to talk a little bit about that. One of the problems, of course, with achieving zettascale is that you have to figure out how to interconnect all these systems. You also have to figure out power and sustainability. Although manufacturing is going in the right direction, the challenges of scaling really are rearing their ugly heads. I think a lot of people expected us to live in a zettascale world in just a few years, but I'm wondering if a lot of people are starting to say, wait a second, maybe we won't be able to achieve that, not because it's physically impossible, but because it's just not practical. We're going to be using too much energy. It's going to cost too much. It's going to take too much to cool it. Maybe it doesn't make sense to deploy these things. Another important thing I think that I'm looking at here is, Intel had hoped, I think, to topple AMD on the top 500 list this time around, but they were unable to do it. So Intel's Aurora is number 2 on the list. AMD's Frontier is number 1. Why is that? Well, because Aurora is not fully operational yet. It's the Death Star, in the first Star Wars movie, not the third one. Anyway, the point is, it's not quite fully operational yet. And when it is, it will almost certainly be the most powerful supercomputer on the top 500 list. But they haven't gotten there yet. They did deploy all the CPUs, all those Xeon Max Sapphire Rapids CPUs and the Ponte Vecchio GPUs and everything. But we're not quite there yet. Another aspect I think that's interesting about the top 500 list is the fact that the overall mix of servers really hasn't changed that much. Intel and AMD are both right there, but neither one is really accelerating. In fact, by the numbers, Intel actually pulled ahead a little bit, but I think that that's maybe spurious. I would say that they're kind of tied. But for me, the most interesting thing is that ARM still isn't really making, shaking things up on the top 500 supercomputer list. The reason this is incredible is because, of course, we've got lots of new products out there, including the Grace Hopper superchip, which, yes, uses ARM CPUs. It's maybe too early, or maybe it's a sign of a change in how HPC is being looked at. Again, if you think about how these systems are going to be used in enterprise and cloud, maybe having the biggest, baddest supercomputer is not really the future of HPC. Maybe the future of HPC is having a big, bad supercomputer that's able to do AI and has a lot of accelerators, has a lot of special instructions, but maybe isn't really focused on topping that list. And I think that that's maybe a more realistic way to look at a lot of things that are happening. You know, we're hearing from, for example, our friends at Liquid with their Ultra Stack, that they're going to be deploying much more flexible GPU accelerator systems. We see AMD talking about, well, there's a lot of rumors and a lot of excitement about what AMD is doing next with their, you know, MI 300, 200 series. And of course, there's NVIDIA right there with the HGX H200 introduction. Now, this thing is really cool. So basically, they're taking the latest Hopper architecture and they're pairing it with HBM3E memory. So you can have up to 141 gigs of memory, which is basically double the capacity and much more, you know, 2.5 times the bandwidth of the A100. And this is an HGX, meaning that it can plop right in there on a server from companies you've heard of, like Dell and HPE and Supermicro. And, you know, they can deploy these things quickly. People can use them quickly. I feel like this is the future of HPC. But of course, there are questions about NVIDIA's ability to deliver this stuff and questions about the timeline. And like I said, there's a lot of excitement about what AMD is doing here. So overall, from my perspective, it just seems like there's a lot of uncertainty and yet a lot of hope, I guess, for what comes out of the HPC space and into the enterprise.
You know, Stephen, again, me being the silly networking person in the corner, I look at this and say, well, we've come from general purpose CPUs, and that eventually wasn't good enough. So we moved to GPUs. And now we're already talking about that potentially not being good enough and how we need to scale. And I'm reading through this article from HPC Wire, and I'm immediately thinking, this is a Moore's Law thing, right? And it's funny because it was actually quoted in this article saying that the end of Moore's Law is coming. There's no doubt about that. And what I find interesting is my personal thought was, okay, according to this article, you're not going to be able to build big enough data centers to scale to this anymore. But I like your perspective on this, Stephen, is that actually, yeah, we probably could. We could continue to physically scale, but at what point does that not make financial or resource or environmental sense anymore? And I think that it, in the world we live in now, that's probably the bigger question here.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll be keeping an eye on it. You know, supercomputing is still going on. In fact, as we're recording, I think NVIDIA is on the stage. So it's too early to say yet what all the news from supercomputing is. But stay tuned next week as we continue our coverage of supercomputing. Now, we've also got some other stuff coming up here. Also today, in fact, live right now, we've got Mobility Field Day. That's where Tom is. Go to techfieldday.com or go, actually, the best place to go is go to LinkedIn and you'll see live video. We've got companies like Ventev, YBot, Cisco presenting over there at Mobility Field Day. Also, just after the Thanksgiving holiday here in the US, we're going to be heading to AWS reInvent. I'll be there personally. If you'd like to set up a meeting, I would love to meet you, whether you're a nerd like me and Tim or one of the companies in the space. We would love to have briefings. We're going to be doing some interviews and so on. So please do reach out to me here at Gestalt IT and let's meet up at AWS. And of course, we've just announced Cloud Field Day and Networking Field Day are returning in January and February, respectively. So take a look at techfieldday.com for those dates. Thanks for watching the Gestalt IT Rundown. You can catch new episodes every Wednesday as a YouTube video or your favorite podcast application. We'll be back next Wednesday to talk about all of the IT news from the week that was. But until then, for myself, for Mr. Tom Hollingsworth, for our good friend Tim Bertino, and from all of us here at the Gestalt IT family, here's wishing you and yours a great day. We'll be right back.